It is Tuesday, February 2nd, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll get VOA national correspondent Jim Malone's take on Monday's Iowa caucuses, the first voting stage of the long U.S. presidential campaign. I'll speak to a reporter from VOA's Korean service about why North Korea is raising international concerns with plans for a satellite launch. And we'll tell you how Saudi women are breaking barriers in their country by getting more involved in sports. It's all ahead on International Edition. The 2016 U.S. presidential campaign has moved to the northeastern state of New Hampshire one day after some surprising caucus results in the central state of Iowa. That's where Republican Senator Ted Cruz won a vote to be his party's presidential nominee by 4 percentage points over second-place finisher Donald Trump. On the Democratic side, former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton defeated Vermont's Democratic Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders by a tiny, tiny margin. My colleague Susan Yaki spoke earlier with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone in Iowa and asked him what most surprised him about the Republican outcome.
I think the air of invincibility that we'd seen for months in polling data was a bit pierced here in Iowa with a win by Ted Cruz. He went the traditional path of counting on especially conservative Christian voters. Trump, you know, underperformed a little bit. And then there was the surprising finish, strong finish of Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, right on Trump's heels. And that's going to really shake up the race.
And it looks like Clinton got a little bit of a scare over in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, a scare in one sense. I think the Bernie Sanders supporters are looking at it as a victory. I mean, it was basically a virtual tie. And now they head to New Hampshire, where Senator Sanders, who's, of course, from neighboring Vermont, has been very strong for months in the polls. And so it's going to be an uphill fight for Hillary Clinton to win in New Hampshire. She'll probably try to get closer to him. I think what it all means is the close finish in Iowa for the two Democrats means that the Democratic primary race is going to go on for quite a while. It's going to be a hard-fought, close contest for a bit. But Clinton at least can claim a very marginal victory there, and that, you know, avoiding a defeat, which I think would have been really difficult.
And we also lost two possible nominees.
Yeah, we did. Martin O'Malley on the Democratic side, who didn't really register much in Iowa or New Hampshire, is suspending his campaign, and Mike Huckabee, who's had made a second bid for the White House after falling short in 2008, Huckabee's leaving the race. I think, you know, once we get past New Hampshire next week, you could see kind of a crowded rush at the door because some of these folks just aren't going to make the cut. New Hampshire will be all about, by the way, finding the establishment alternative to Trump and Cruz. And Rubio right now is perhaps the leading contender for that, but he's going to have a lot of competition in New Hampshire from people like Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, and John Kasich.
Well, with this Trump not coming in first, do you think he knew that beforehand? Did you sense anything from his camp about the vote yesterday?
There was some low-key Trump that we haven't seen before. And he's getting some kudos for his sort of gracious, speech, acknowledging that he came in second. We'll see what happens in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is a state that has been very favorable to him so far in the polls. I think the question is, what kind of a bounce does Rubio get heading up to New Hampshire now? And even Cruz. Cruz is not a great fit for New Hampshire because he's very conservative. But, it's a very jumbled and kind of, competitive Republican race right now. And I think a lot of different things could happen.
And that was VOA national correspondent Jim Malone with International Edition's Susan Yaki. Let's turn now to our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio for reactions to Monday's caucuses. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So what have the winners and losers been saying on Twitter about the caucuses?
Well, before that, I want to ask you a question. I don't know which party's result was more interesting for you, But why don't we start with Donald Trump like we did yesterday?
Sounds good to me.
So this is Trump's reaction. My experience in Iowa was a great one. I started out with all the experts saying I couldn't do well there and ended up in the second place. Nice. More than 4,000 people shared that tweet. The following two tweets are a bit of explanation, if you will, as to why he lost to Ted Cruz. He said that because he was told he couldn't do well in Iowa anyway, he spent very little there. A fraction of what Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio spent, actually. He also blamed the media, per usual, saying it hasn't covered his long-shot, quote-unquote, great finish in Iowa fairly.
So Trump is trying to maybe downplay expectations now, mm-hmm. but he did say recently that he could even shoot someone and wouldn't lose voters, right?
Exactly. And that's even what he said during his rally in Iowa. So it's not too easy to believe he thought winning in Iowa was a long shot. But turning to Ted Cruz, he sent out a brief message. He wrote, "Thank you, Iowa. This is our time. Join us at tedcruz.org. Less than 3,000 people retweeted that.
Okay, so not as many retweets as for Trump's tweet, but what is Clinton saying on the Democratic side?
Well, I think Clinton is trying to appear more personable, especially on social media platforms. And when the results from a very close race, as you saw with Bernie Sanders, came out, she sent out this tweet. "From the bottom of my heart, thank you, Iowa," signed H. Most of her tweets are sent by her campaign staffers, but the ones from Hillary Clinton herself are signed with her initial.
Well, Bernie Sanders also had quite a good night, didn't he?
He did. Like Jim Malone said, it was a virtual tie. Sanders tweeted this. "We accomplished what the political establishment said was impossible. Don't underestimate us." And I think that's a really good point because many people are questioning whether his relatively newfound, especially nationally, and youth-driven popularity is sustainable. That's all for me today, Michael.
Well, thank you, G. We'll find out in New Hampshire whether he can sustain that. Well, you can follow G and myself on Twitter. We are at G Abby Lee and at Michael underscore Lippin. You can also follow this show on Twitter. We are at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
We're making yoga really accessible for a lot of people that normally wouldn't set foot in a yoga studio. We get a lot of people that are brand new to yoga, have never tried it before. A lot of people that get bribed to be here with beer on the agenda.
That's right. Instructor Sheila Davis said beer. She's teaching a yoga class at Florida's Miami Brewing Company.
Right back into Downward Facing Dog. It's okay to moan.
Practitioners tout yoga's benefits for improved flexibility, muscle strength, and tone, but the people taking this class admit they're here for different reasons.
I did it because the girlfriend wanted me to come and free beer.
The girls usually love the yoga and the men usually love the craft beer, so this is a way to get both of them together at the same time and to do it as a couple and enjoy it. And the men who don't think they love yoga may love it in the end.
Yoga and craft beer are both expanding industries in the United States. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. A UN agency says North Korea plans to launch a four-year weather observation satellite into orbit later this month. The launch would come weeks after the reclusive state claimed to have tested a hydrogen bomb. Earlier, I spoke to VOA Korean service reporter Eun Jung Cho and asked her why the United States and others are expressing so much concern about Pyongyang's planned satellite launch.
You know, North Korea has said that its space program is peaceful, but it is still believed to be developing an intercontinental ballistic missile that could strike not only South Korea and Japan, but also the United States. And as you know very well, that North Korea has already conducted four nuclear tests. So if you put a nuclear warhead on a missile and launch it to, you know, attack another country, that could be a nuclear war.
But North Korea is insisting that the purpose of this launch is to put a weather satellite into orbit. So why should we not believe them, that this is purely for the purposes of weather and science?
Right. If we look at the technology, you know, it's a crossover technology. A satellite launch utilizes technology also found in ballistic missiles. And North Korea already successfully put an object into orbit in December 2012. But still, North Korea still does not have a very critical element of a ballistic missile technology, which is called a re-entry vehicle capability, which means, you know, a warhead cannot withstand the stress of an atmosphere re-entry. Even though North Korea still hasn't had this very critical technology, experts are still very cautious about North Korea's pursuit of a long-range rocket technology, because in the future, there is a possibility that North Korea can obtain this technology and successfully launch a missile.
Well, what do United Nations resolutions say about whether North Korea can engage in this kind of activity?
Well, the United Nations Security Council has banned North Korea from missile tests after its nuclear tests in 2006 and 2009 and 2012. UN resolutions prohibited North Korea from launches because, you know, as I said, the technology could be used as a dual-use applications to a ballistic missile technology. One of the resolutions in detail, if I may introduce, for instance, 1718, says that it decides the DPRK, which is North Korea, shall suspend all activities related to its ballistic missile program and, in this context, reestablish its pre-existing commitments to a moratorium on missile launching.
Well, thank you so much, Eunjung Cho of VOA's Korean service, for telling us why people are concerned about this upcoming satellite launch. Thank you.
Thank you.
A county in the southwestern U.S. state of Texas is reporting what appears to be the first case of the mosquito-borne Zika virus being transmitted by sexual contact. On Monday, the World Health Organization declared the spread of the Zika virus to be a global public health emergency. Sanjaya Sinanayake is an associate professor in medicine and an expert on infectious diseases at Australian National University. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that Zika poses a serious global health risk on two levels.
The explosive nature of the outbreak, because as you well know, in the last year, even though it's had a very low profile for some decades, in the last year, it's managed to jump across to Central and South America, right on the doorsteps of the United States, and probably caused millions of cases. Now, that alone may not be that bad if the illness were mild, but of course, now there is strong concern. We're not 100% sure, but there's strong concern that it is responsible for a serious birth defect called microcephaly.
Is there an effective treatment for it?
No, there is none. It's a viral illness, and unlike most bacterial illnesses where you can use antibiotics, there's very limited treatment for viral infections. So there's no treatment for Zika at the moment.
How likely is this to spread beyond South America?
Well, it probably already has. It was first recognized in Uganda, the Zika forest in Uganda, where it was isolated in monkeys there. And it's been responsible for periodic small outbreaks in Africa and parts of Asia. And then in 2007, it moved to the Pacific Islands before this explosive outbreak in Central and South America. So it's already established in some parts of the world. We know that it's there in Thailand, for instance. There might be cases in Indonesia. And the main problem with it is most people who get infected with this don't get symptoms. Or if you're in the minority who do get symptoms, it's a very non-specific flu-like illness. So it is quite possible that a lot of cases of Zika in other parts of the world, such as Asia, are not being recognized or are being diagnosed as something else, such as dengue.
Are pregnant women the most at risk?
Absolutely. Most other people, non-pregnant people who get Zika, are likely not to get a sickness or get a nasty flu-like illness from which they'll recover without needing to go to hospital. But if this link is proven, and as I said, we think it's likely to be the cause, but we're not 100% sure. But yes, pregnant women are the ones at serious risk.
What does the WHO's public health emergency do for health authorities worldwide?
The public health emergency of international concern is really a ramped up public health response to what is regarded as a global emergency. And I believe this is the fourth time they've invoked that, the first time being with swine flu back in 2009, and then with Ebola and polio in Syria.
And that was Sanjaya Sananayake of Australian National University speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Saudi Arabia's female athletes say sports are helping them to break cultural conventions in the conservative Muslim state. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from the Saudi city of Jeddah on a group of female basketball players who are giving a greater voice to women and girls.
One of the richest countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia is in many ways as modern as any place on earth in terms of infrastructure and conveniences. But activists say the kingdom has a long way to go in terms of women's rights. In the coastal city Jeddah, activists say by encouraging women and girls to play basketball and other sports, they promote health and chip away at the image of Saudi women as virtually silent members of their society. Wearing white uniforms with long pants and Islamic headscarves, the Jeddah United women's team plays an exhibition game in Malaysia. Officials say by playing internationally, Saudi women broaden their own horizons, as well as those of the nations they visit. This is Lina Al-Maina, who heads the Jeddah United Sports Company.
We played in the United States, in Malaysia, in Jordan, and the UAE, as well as Riyadh and other cities in Saudi Arabia. So we do that locally to promote sports and internationally to also try to change stereotypes and show a different segment in Saudi Arabia.
At a charity event in Jeddah promoting sports for handicapped boys and girls, female basketball players say women's sports are increasingly popular at home, and there is a wait list to get on their team. Player Noor Gary says defying stereotypes in Saudi Arabia requires pushing boundaries without breaking them. Men do not attend games, and players only allow cameras in when they are fully covered. But she says many people do not approve.
And it's not even against the law or against the religion. It's just people having their own beliefs and trying to close it on other people. So yeah, being open towards sports means that they have more flexibility towards other things.
Players say women's rights in Saudi Arabia have come far in recent years, but many basic freedoms, like the right to drive cars, remain elusive. Last year, women in Saudi Arabia voted for the first time, and 20 women were voted into local office. Like politicians, female athletes say they believe women's sports will eventually be accepted more publicly. This is Jeddah United coach Deborah Parkwood.
We have some great athletes here in Saudi Arabia. Some of the girls that really, they want to play harder, they want to train harder, and they would love to compete for their country internationally.
In the meantime, players say promoting women's sports locally is having an immediate impact on society, showing women the benefits of exercise for themselves and for their children. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
Just in time for Valentine's Day, a new film adaptation of author Nicholas Sparks' 2007 novel, The Choice, opens in U.S. theaters on Friday. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the movie looks at the issues of love, loss, and hope.
Travis Parker and Gabby Holland start off as neighbors. Parker, played by Benjamin Walker, best known for Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter and 2015's In the Heart of the Sea, he is a laid-back, happy-go-lucky Southern charmer. He enjoys his life by the beach, being with his friends, being carefree, and especially not being tied down. That all changes when Gabby Holland moves in next door. Holland is played by Australian actress Teresa Palmer and the heat between the two characters is instantaneous. But both are in relationships with other people. Travis with his on-again, off-again high school love, and Gabby with a successful doctor. Palmer says that the love affair, which spans a decade during the story, is about her character following her heart, even though it would mean hurting someone who loves her.
Life is just not black and white, and this movie actually helped me eradicate some of my own judgments surrounding cheating and all those sorts of things, because she truly is in a battle between her head and her heart, and she doesn't want to inflict pain on anyone or make anyone else suffer, but she has to lean in to what her heart sings, and that's being with this man. And yes, it's messy and crazy and scary and confusing, but that's life. I mean, life is full of peaks and valleys.
Benjamin Walker says that thinking that Gabby is cheating because she chooses Travis over her previous boyfriend is a silly double standard.
And it's that level of judgment that's kind of ridiculous. And I feel like if it was a man in the movie, there'd be this kind of double standard. You know, it would be understandable. And I think it's ridiculous.
Walker and Palmer both say the story deals with some tough issues that all people face. And to say that the love portrayed is based on cheating isn't being realistic.
That's how life is. And it's that level of judgment where we say this is right and this is wrong that divides us as people and as men and women and as different cultures. And I think that's really unfair. And what she's supposed to do, be in this relationship for the rest of her life where she's not happy?
Because of other people's standards?
Yeah, because of someone else's, what they want to label her as. I think that's ridiculous.
The crux of the story takes a dramatic twist when Gabby is in a car accident and goes into a coma. Doctors have told Travis that Gabby probably will never recover, and he has to decide whether to take her off life support or not. The Choice also stars Maggie Grace as Travis's sister Stephanie. Tom Welling stars as Dr. Ryan McCarthy, Gabby's boyfriend. Oscar nominee Tom Wilkinson stars as Dr. Shep. Author Nicholas Sparks co-wrote the screenplay with Brian Sipe. Ross Katz, who co-produced Lost in Translation with Oscar winner Sofia Coppola, directed the film. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And that's International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent trip to Cambodia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry expressed his hope that Cambodia will realize the full benefits of a thriving multi-party democracy. He said the U.S. cares deeply about respect for human rights, universal freedoms, and good governance. And progress in each of these areas is really critical to being able to fulfill the potential of our bilateral relations, but also, importantly, the full potential of the hopes and aspirations of the Cambodian people. In his discussions with Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, Secretary Kerry further stressed that democratic governments have a responsibility to ensure that all elected representatives are free to perform their responsibilities without fear of attack or arrest. This includes opposition party leader Samrong Si, who was forced into exile after the government called for his arrest for allegedly defaming Foreign Minister Hau Nam Hong. So as Cambodians prepare for elections next year, and again in 2018, it is very important to allow for vigorous but peaceful debate. The U.S. remains interested in developing its economic relations with Cambodia. Indeed, the United States is Cambodia's largest single-country export market today. Last November, both countries held their first competitiveness and growth dialogue. Now, said Secretary Kerry, we look forward to trade and investment framework agreement talks that will take place soon. And we will continue to explore ways to deepen our trade and investment relationships, including by helping to tackle corruption and exploring ways to strengthen Cambodia's legal institutions. To that end, the United States looks forward to welcoming Cambodia to the U.S.-ASEAN summit in February. A thread of common concern to both the U.S. and Cambodia is countering violent extremism. Prime Minister Hun Sen expressed interest in Cambodia working with the U.S.-led coalition against Daesh. The U.S. also cooperates with Cambodia on other issues, including health and food security and mine clearance. There are active Fulbright and Peace Corps programs on the ground in Cambodia, and the U.S. continues to help with sustainable development in the Mekong River region. The U.S. remains deeply committed to its partnership with Cambodia and with all the members of ASEAN on a regional and global basis.